now. Let's say hello to Owen Murphy, who's the project manager with Breeding Waders EIP. Owen is looking for landowners to join his club, so to speak. Anyway, Owen, you're very welcome to the programme. Set out your stall, remind everybody what you guys do and tell us what you're looking for.
Hi, Derek, and thanks for having me. So the Breeding Waders EIP project, I suppose, we started last year. It's a €25 million project for the next 5 years, and it's co-funded by the National Parks and Wildlife Service and the Department of Agriculture, Food and the Marine. And I suppose the project itself, it aims to secure existing breeding wader populations throughout the country and also support population recovery in other areas as well through landscape management and policy development. So that's sort of what we're about.
And you want to recruit landowners?
Yeah, well, I suppose when you work on any conservation project in Ireland, you're at the behest of landowners, because such a large proportion of our country is privately owned and privately owned and farming, you know. So at the moment, we're in the process of recruiting farmers, and these are farmers that may have an interest in being part of the project. The project itself will sit down with farmers. We will discuss how their land might suit breeding waders, what measures we can implement. If the farmer agrees and everything goes according to plan, the farmer is then paid a participation fee and a management fee for implementing those measures on his or her farmland.
Now, how do you know which tracts of land are suitable? Because we get a lot of winter visitors, but they don't appear on every patch of grass.
Yeah, well, I suppose prior to this recruitment, we had done quite a bit of work on identifying where breeding waders still remain in Ireland. And those areas we are calling our wader action zones. So parts of Donegal in the northwest coast, Lough Corrib and west of Lough Corrib into Connemara and up into Mayo, and then Lough Ree and the Mid-Shannon Callows. They are sort of our three core areas. But there's other areas. We will implement some management plans on parts of the east coast. We have a couple of development farmers already up and running in Kildare. So it's not confined to those areas, but those are the three areas that still have relatively strong breeding whaler populations. So it makes sense, I suppose, to start there, develop our plans, get a core and get a nucleus of breeding birds, hopefully, you know, doing relatively well, and then build on that.
Now, let's say I'm a farmer and I've got birds on my land and I want to help them. And by signing up to your scheme, I am going to help them. I'm going to get a few bob in return. But can I use the land as I wish after signing up? Or does it in theory belong to you?
No, it certainly doesn't. I suppose the one thing, that there's often a perception that there's a clash between agriculture, between farmers and conservationists, or people that are working to try and protect birds or species or habitat or whatever it is. Certainly not the case with waders. Waders are reliant on farming. As we all know, if you stop and leave land alone in Ireland, it will relatively quickly revert back to scrub and then to woodland and, you know, succession into mature woodland. And these birds won't use woodland. So they're actually, you know, they disassociate with woodland. There's lots of studies around that show that birds don't breed that close to woodland. So they're reliant on farming. And I suppose whether they became harmonised with our timing of farming, or it just happens that the timing of our farming, you know, harmonised with their breeding cycles, they sort of merged. And what we had up until, I suppose, relatively recently in agricultural practice, we had birds coming down as water levels retreated in some of these areas that these birds like. Grass started to grow, they went down, had their chicks, and by the time they had fledged, then it was getting into summertime, and then we saved hay and did what we have to do. So there was a cycle there that these birds fitted into very well. I suppose over the last 40 years, some of the things that we have done have changed. Some of our timing of our farming practices have changed. So you remember hay meadows and, you know, late summer hay meadows. That a lot in places that has changed to silage. And silage is just earlier. It doesn't mean that we are saying to people, don't knock any meadow, don't save any fodder. I mean, farmers have to do that. It's the timing of which you do these things. As we all know, I mean, if you roll a field or if you knock meadow during the breeding season when there's a bird on eggs or when there's very small chicks, those eggs or those chicks won't survive. So it's the timing of those things. So I suppose it's sitting down with each individual farmer saying, what do you do? What's your farming practice? And what can we do to, I suppose, turn the tide in favour of the birds again and pay the farmer for doing so. I mean, these farmers, I suppose, to have it in their hands to implement these changes. And what we have to do as a project is draw up the plans and get some favourable outcomes and then pay the farmer accordingly.
Well, presumably the farmer was always managing his land or her land according to the seasons, and things had to be done at a certain time of year. I mean, if they don't do it at the time of year that you don't want them to do it, does that mean that stuff is wasted, that the crop is gone? I'm just asking out loud, excuse my ignorance.
Yeah, not really. I suppose it's probably reverting back to a timing. Because, I mean, Ireland had a very, very strong breeding whaler population up until the 1970s into the 1980s. And the decline really started from the 1990s on. So we changed how we use land, and our farming practices changed, our machinery got bigger, but it was really the timing of what we were doing. I mean, if machinery got bigger and people still saved hay in you know, 80 or 90% of the fodder crop was still hay, well then that would be late summer and a lot of the birds would have fledged. But when I suppose silage took over very, very quickly as a fodder crop, and it just it's 6 or 8 weeks earlier, and it just clashes with where these birds are. That's not the only I suppose pressure that they're under. The reason why their populations are in such serious decline is that they're under threat from a lot of other area, a lot of other things too. I mean, our afforestation policy over the last 30 years has been Sika spruce plantations primarily on marginal ground or wetter ground. You don't see, you know, Sika spruce plantations on prime dairy or tillage land. And it just happened that the type of birds that we're dealing with use that type of land. So that's another block of land that is taken out of use for these birds. Bord pneumonia, I mean, Ireland had to develop as a country and we used turf as a means of producing electricity. But I mean, the offside of that was that, you know, we removed an awful lot of pristine bog. So an awful lot of the habitat that these birds are using has been degraded, or the things that we are doing, we've changed our timing. So it's not that we're saying to a farmer, you can't do this, cease all operations. It's about putting in stocking rates, sward management, you know, when you take your fodder, when you use pesticides or herbicides. Well, we're asking farmers not to use either because that's their food source. Mm-hmm. So there's a suite of measures that we're putting in place. And I mean, the vast majority of farmers that we've talked to so far have, most of them actually enjoy the fact that they still have birds on their land, that these birds have now become very rare and their land is now special. And they realise that. So it's paying them to maintain that and to enhance it.
Are some birds worth more than others? Do you pay one farmer more money than another farmer, depending on what species he or she has on the land?
No. I suppose our template for our farm plan is standard. I mean, where it may vary is that some of the species are grassland species, some are upland species. And it just happens in those instances, you know, sometimes you get really, really large swathes of upland. And other places down in the Callows, you would have very, very small strips of privately owned land. I mean, and that's the only really difference in it. What we're asking farmers to do, and when we're bringing them on board, is we go through that in detail. We're not an area-based scheme. We're not a scorecard based scheme. So right. We have flexibility in how we pay.
But I mean, I could say, listen, things haven't been good for the last few years. I'd really like to help out the birds, but I've plans for that field. You know, unless you can give me a few more bob, I'm not going to buy into it. I'm sorry. No disrespect, but that's just the situation I find myself in. So can a farmer negotiate with you? Just wondering out loud.
Yeah, well, I don't know. Is
am I opening a can of worms
well,
here?
No, you're certainly not. No, you're certainly not. And I suppose that's why what we've set out to do is sit down with each farmer individually and see what his or her needs are, see what their stocking rates are, for example, or see what their current farming practices are. And see, I mean, I suppose in a lot of ways where conservation projects struggle is that, you know, in very intensively farmed land, such as large dairy farms or very, really large tillage farms, those type of farms are really, really large in scale, nearly industrial. Most of the farmers, I suppose, that are coming to us are the smaller farms, people maybe that are farming part-time, or people that have a marginal plot of land as part of their land that, you know, maybe they have tried to drain and it hasn't happened, you know, it's still retaining water. It's those sort of areas that we're targeting. And when we sit down to talk to somebody, the management plan itself and how much that farmer is paid is sort of how much do they have to implement. In a lot of cases, which sounds a little bit at variance to a lot of other projects, we're paying people not to change. You know, if the birds are still there and the birds are still doing well,
yeah,
and
don't
say on an
do
island
anything.
In Loch Ree,
just leave
it. Well, you're paying them. You know, give a commitment not to start using pesticides if you're not using them already, not to start draining if you haven't drained already. So it's a commitment to retain the land as much as a commitment to change back to what they're doing in some instances.
Yeah, it's good to talk to you, and I'm just very interested in all of this. I mean, the change to silage cutting from haymaking has been ubiquitous because there's more nourishment out of the silage than there is of the dried hay, and the weather's bad and you don't get your hay, and the hay made in Cork bet. I mean, it was in the psyche for so long, and it was always a dicey thing with the weather. And that's one thing, but you see the silage fields when they're cut in May, and they are covered black with crows, corvids, all feeding on the worms and all the stuff that are exposed. So the amount of predators have increased enormously because of this changeover to silage. So you have to cope with this as well now, because these predators are going to feed on the eggs of ground nesting birds. So is there any scheme specially looking at that aspect of it, at the predation link between the number of curlews, the number of ground nesting lapwings, whatever we have, and the amount of corvids that are predators on them on the ground?
Yeah, I mean, we've looked at this, and I suppose when we were first putting in our application for how we would manage a breeding wader EAP of this size, two things, there were sort of two tenants. One was habitat, and the other is predation. As you say, Ireland has become a very, very favourable place for our generalist predators, and also some introduced predators such as mink, which associate with, you know, watery environments. So that's a huge part. And I suppose at the moment we're in the process of rolling out training, a certified course for nest protection officers in Ireland. And that will be, I suppose, a holistic look at how these birds on the ground are affected by predation. It's not just lethal control of predators. It's also, you know, fencing. It's improving habitat to make the habitat harder for predators to negotiate and to try and redress the balance a small bit. But I mean, it's a huge problem. There's study after study shows that, I suppose, in the scheme of things, there's a habitat and a degradation of habitat affecting these birds. But there's also an increase in generalist predator populations, and that's also driving their demise. I suppose as our habitat changes and becomes more, you know, level and flat, it's easier for these predators to locate nests. We've sort of got rid of the myriad of little habitats that would be within, you know, larger fields. And a lot of them are, you know, very plain, very open, and again, very easy for predators to hunt in.
Owen, it seems to me you are faced with changing Irish farming culture radically. If you take the criteria for conservation, you have birds that are critically endangered at one end of the spectrum. You have those that are vulnerable, and then you have those that are not affected by conservation issues. Now, have you identified the critically endangered ones? And you could devote a hell of a lot of time. I'm thinking of the red-necked phalarope off Mayo. That is gone, I think. Now, to spend a lot of effort on trying to get it back or trying to get the marginal ones back would be not very effective financially, whereas if you concentrate on some middle of the road one, that you might do better. Is this the way it works?
Well, I suppose our remit is to look after 10 breeding wader species, one of which is the redneck phalarope. They're still doing okay on Anna Marsh. Birdwatch Ireland have a large predator exclusion fence that was just replaced this year. It's a fantastic piece of habitat. Dave Sotheby down there is doing great work. So a redneck phalarope is still there. I mean, I don't know how big a population of redneck phalarope were ever breeding in Ireland. It was probably always very small. No, but your point is right. Some of these birds, say lapwing, for example, lapwing have declined enormously. I mean, we think around by 80% in Ireland, but there's still probably 800 or 900 pairs in Ireland. And what lapwing can provide, if you look after lapwing and you get a strong breeding lapwing colony, is that you will often get other waders coming in behind them, because they will sit in beside the lapwing and they get the protection from a lapwing's defence. As we all know, lapwing are very, very feisty, and if there's a good, strong breeding lapwing population, say a grey crow or a buzzard or something flies over, you'll very, very quickly get loads of lapwing up in the air mobbing them. And generally, you know, an awful lot of time you'll see those avian predators, they'll just head off about their business because it's not worth it. NPWS in Kilcool, I mean, they had three or four pairs of lapwing at Cool Dross before they put in their nest protection fence. Now they have 60 or 70 pairs of lapwing, and they've also now got in Redshank and some other breeding waders in behind it. So you will get that, you will get that sort of knock-on effect. Other ones, I mean, that they're critically low, such as Curlew, and I mean, we have to concentrate on them. We only have 100 pairs or 120 pairs of Curlew left. So if we don't invest in trying to hang on to those Curlew, we'll probably get to the stage that the breeding Curlew population, if there was any left, would be too small anyway to be functionally viable. So I suppose there's a balance. I mean, we can't really, I suppose, sit in our hands and say we'll concentrate on lapwing and we let Curlew expire. But I suppose it's a holistic approach. What works for one ground nesting bird will work for others. And there's co-benefits, I suppose, when you're dealing with the things we're dealing with for all birds that nest in the ground. If you do professional and focused nest protection work in an area, you know, meadow pipits and skylarks, hen harrier, all those other birds will all benefit from it.
Well, now, are you waiting for the farmers to come to you and say, I have curlews on my farm and I want to keep them? Or are you canvassing the countryside, looking for places where there which need your help, and then approaching, knocking on the door of the farmer and saying, I'd like to remind you of your duties with regard to this particular bird? What is the approach there? Are you a kind of fire brigade consultants that are brought in to help when somebody is on board? Or are you somebody out there trying to change hearts and minds to make them do the right thing?
We're sort of a balance of both. I mean, there's probably certain landowners out there that maybe are unaware that their land is valuable or that their land has for breeding birds or for breeding waders. And there's others then, I suppose, we're following on some really solid work that was done by the Curlew Conservation Programme and by the breeding Curlew EIP. One was NPWS ran, one was Birdwatch ran. So like for Curlew, I suppose we have already identified a lot of the areas that still have Curlew, and there would be associations there with landowners already. So it's continuing that and building on it. In other areas, you know, where there might be lapwing or redshank, we are recruiting. So we had a recruitment evening for the Shannon Callows, one on the east side of the Callows and one on the west side of the Callows the week before last. And they were really, really positive.
So these are like town hall meetings, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly. We'd give a short presentation on what the project is, what we're about, and then it's really sit down and you know, show to landowners that we're here, that we're not we don't come along with a dictator type approach, that we're sitting down and we're working with people. Because I mean, if farmers don't come on board, our project fails. So we need to get the farmers on board. There's certain things that we can't say to farmers, yeah, come on board and you know, we'll pay you and you go ahead and do that, such as rolling ground during the breeding season or such as not meadow. But I mean, these are things I usually say to farmers. If I asked a farmer and I said, there's a breeding bird on the ground over there sitting on a nest of eggs, how would you protect it? The farmer will say very similar things to what we're asking them to do. So they know themselves. And if they're getting paid, and if they're getting, you know, and if the management plan and they feel part of the project, and I think in a lot of ways, if they then get the respect of the community. I mean, a lot of farmers at the moment that have conservation work going on in their land, people don't know about it. Whereas if you're walking down to the local shop and they're saying, oh, there's Patricia or there's James, that they have the breeding lapwing on their land or they're looking after the birds.
Do you think that makes a difference, really?
I think it does, yeah. No, I think it definitely does.
Owen, I wanted to go back to the beginning, really. EIP is the European Innovation Partnership. Now, that's a new thing. I mean, you know, is this part of CAP? Is it to do with agriculture? Is it to do with this land use preservation? Or is it a different scheme altogether? Could you tell us what this EIP is in the first place and what it covers?
Yeah, an EIP, as you say, it's an innovation partnership. But I suppose what it was built around was, if there's a problem identified, this is an EIP agri, so in an agricultural context, if there's a problem identified on the ground, instead of Owen Murphy or somebody else trying to solve that problem by themselves, you sit down and you pull in stakeholders that would be involved in it. So everybody sits down around the table together and you come up, and that, I mean, we hope then that you put your best foot forward and you get a favourable outcome. I suppose in this case, instead of just a group of ornithologists or just a group of farmers or just a group of academics trying to solve that problem, if everybody is sitting down around the table together, it makes sense, or, you know, it I suppose it stands to reason that you may have a better chance of getting a positive outcome. So in this case, we're recruiting farmers, and farmers are part of what we are, and a huge part of what we are. But we also have nest protection officers. We also have research academics. We also have Fota Wildlife Park and Dublin Zoo, you know, other parts of our projects, Head Starting, which is taking eggs from the wild and hatching the chicks and releasing them back into their natural environment. The Hen Harrier Project are also a project partner of ours. So we're getting people that have, I suppose, knowledge of what we think are all the different aspects sitting down around together. And I suppose that's the fundamental concept of an EIP.
Yeah, but it's on the European level, and you're doing the wader one. I mean, are there EIPs for other things besides waders?
There is. Oh, yeah, there's EIPs for loads and loads of other things. And actually, Ireland has had quite a number of EIPs, but they're generally maybe of a more short term and a smaller budget. This one, the problem with waders, I suppose, was identified a number of years ago. And unusually, ours is funded through CAP and through the Department of Agriculture, but also through the NPWS and Exchequer funding. So it's sort of a hybrid. It's a combination of the two. But no, I mean, and they have been, I suppose, around for a number of years. The Hen Harrier project, quite a number of years ago, was an EIP initially, and that has sort of transformed into an acres or an acre CP type management. But they're here, and in some instances, like every project, in some instances they have proved to be very successful. So I mean, we're hoping that we can replicate that as we roll out. But I think that's the core message, I suppose, for people from my point of view, is that it's not any one group domineering over the other. It's about everybody trying to work together to, you know, to drive change for these birds, because they really are. I mean, if we, there's a term called extirpation, and that means gone, you know, locally extinct. We will lose our Irish breeding wader species, a number of them, in the next 10 years if something doesn't change. So even to have core areas that these birds are still doing all right, and you know, and their conservation status in those areas would be deemed favourable, it will give us a chance then, maybe as acres and more general landscape type changes happen in certain areas, that there will be some birds to go and exploit that new habitat as it comes online.
Niall, you want to say something there?
Yes, Alan. I think that the work that you're doing as part of this EIP, it's absolutely phenomenal. It's just in the nick of time, I think, as well, because what's concerned me over the years most about breeding waders is just how rapid that decline has been. And they've gone from, in some cases, from being abundant to being almost gone in the space of just a few decades. The curlew being a classic example of that. But there are many other, perhaps less famous species that follow the same pattern. I think that for me, the key word in the EIP is the I, is the innovation. That's a big part of this, isn't it? It's testing what works so that therefore it can be rolled out elsewhere. And this could also then have knock-on benefits, not just in Ireland, but in other European countries as well, where they're struggling with wader populations. Places like the Netherlands, for example, where I know there's some similar issues.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, innovation is, and it, in one way, you know, when you talk about breeding wader recovery and breeding wader conservation, people will say, well, we sort of know what needs to happen for breeding waders. And in some instances, we do. I mean, we know the type of habitat they like. We know the fact that predation is a huge pressure. We know that they don't like when you change open landscapes into wooded landscapes and these sort of things. But I suppose in an Irish context, it's even innovative in rolling it out on a national level. As you know, Neil, I mean, NPWS and Birdwatch and others have had smaller projects in small focused areas that have shown good results for breeding waders. But it's to put that into a national context, that instead of you're looking after a small subset of a population that's doing all right, but the rest of the population is still in rapid decline. What we would like to see is that farmers are coming up with ideas as well, that there's landowners out there that turn around and say, well, what if we tried this? And that the innovation part of our project can spearhead that, can say, well, hold on a second, that makes sense, let's go and try it. Because sometimes you get the, you know, it sort of comes across that the people that are running these projects are telling landowners what to do at all stages, that, you know, that the landowner wouldn't know what to do themselves unless there was somebody telling them at all stages. And I think that's not necessarily true. People that farm land, they know the land in instances like, you know, along the Callows where water fluctuates, they know what land is going to be wet, what land is going to dry first, all these sort of things. So it's putting that into practice and taking the knowledge that, I suppose, has been handed down through generations from a lot of these farmers and in uplands and a lot of these rural areas.
Owen, thank you very much indeed.
Thanks, Derek.
That's pretty much all we have time for tonight. My thanks to Eoin Nealana, Richard Collins, Niall Hatch and Terry Flanagan. Visit the website, as I've said, rte.ie/Mooney. Until next week at the same time, goodbye, goodbye, goodbye.
And Mooney Goes Wild is presented and produced by Derek Mooney.
Email mooney@rte.ie.